are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Let us not seize upon ideas, neither shall we hunt them down nor steal them away. Rather, let us wait faithfully for them to approach, slowly, gently, like creatures in the wild. And let them enter willingly into our hearts and come and go freely within the sanctuary of our contemplation. Informing our souls as they arrive and being enlivened by the inspiration of our hearts as they leave. These shall be our truest thoughts, our willing and effective ideas. Let us treasure their humble originality. Let us follow them gently back into the world with faith that they shall lead us to lives of harmony and integrity. We'll now have a little silence before the interlude.
Today's reading is a letter written by Martin Luther in 1527, soon after the bubonic plague struck the town of Wittenberg in Germany. And this was a time where towns were falling like dominoes, so to speak, smitten by the bubonic plague. It was on its way to the town of Breslau. And the minister at Breslau wanted some advice from Martin Luther as to the proper way to deal with this as Christians. So Martin Luther replies, "You wish to know whether it is proper for a Christian to run away from a deadly plague. If one makes no use of intelligence or medicine when he could do so without detriment to his neighbour, such a person injures his body and he becomes a suicide in God's eyes. By the same reasoning, a person might forego eating and drinking, clothing and shelter, and boldly proclaim his faith that if God wanted to preserve him from starvation and cold, he could do so without food and clothing. Now that would be suicide. It is even more shameful for a person to pay no heed to his own body by failing to protect it against the plague as best he is able, and then to infect others who might otherwise have remained alive had he taken care of his body as he should have. He is thus responsible before God for his neighbour's death. Imagine a house catching fire in the city without anyone attempting to put it out. The whole city would be consumed. Those who stood by and did nothing might justify their inaction by saying that if God so willed, he could save the city without needing men and water to quench the flames. No, my dear friends, that thinking is wrong. use medicine, take potions which can help you, fumigate house, yard and street, and avoid persons and places where your presence is no longer needed. An epidemic is like a fire, but instead of consuming wood and straw, an epidemic devours life and body. You should think this way. The enemy has sent this pandemic. I shall then ask God mercifully to protect us. I shall then fumigate, help purify the air, administer medicine, and take it. I shall avoid places and persons where my presence is not needed, so that I don't become contaminated and infect others and cause their death by my negligence. And if God should wish to take me, he will surely find that I have done what he has expected of me, that I'm therefore not responsible either for my own death or the death of others, and that I shall have helped my neighbour whenever and wherever I'm needed. For a God-fearing faith is neither brash nor foolhardy and does not tempt God.
It's rather fascinating, isn't it, that idea of tempting God? But all the things that are referred to in that very long letter are all the stuff that we can see today, the violence and the folly and the heartache. So I chose the topic fear today. Now, I never showed any class I ever taught Watership Down. This was because despite its universal rating, I could imagine what nightmares could come from the fierce battles and the blood-soaked premonitions of the little rabbit called Fiver. Now, I was teaching at Peterborough Primary School when the novel became popular. One of the high school English teachers was married to Noel, an inspector at Metro Export Meatworks. He described it as a deeply subversive book. "Why is that, Noel?" I asked him one night at the pub. It transpired that on his way to work the previous day, for the first time in his life, he swerved to miss a rabbit. Clearly, this was a deeply disturbing experience. Now, as much as we seek out fear in horror movies or on television, in real life, fear gets a very bad rap. Fear is something to conquer, to overcome, defeat, avoid, confront. Having been a caver for 15 years, I came to see the upside of fear. There's nothing worse than having some awful lunkhead, fearless lunkhead, in the party when you're abseiling down a cave. What you want around you is people who double-check the equipment, people who don't step on the climbing ropes, they don't head off on their own or use old ladders, and the people who use the jargon. "On belay, lay on, climbing, lie on, slack, etc., etc." On the other hand, the fear surrounding the pandemic seems to produce two contrasting results. The one is what I see today: people in masks, people who've had a shot or two, people who use the QR response, hand sanitise, people who, in Luther's words, do not tempt God. And then we have the opposite: people who resist. Some people seem suicidal, others murderous. Some are naively foolish, all the types that Luther describes in his 12-page letter in response to the question of what to do, what the Christian thing to do is in a plague. Well, in 600 years, not a lot has changed. The secular cohort has grown, but they still exhibit the contrasting responses to pandemic. Compliance, cooperation on one side, or resistance, denial, generation of conspiracy theories, rioting rage on the other. Now, Brazil is one of the worst hit countries. In 2020, Sao Paulo lost two prominent musical directors on the very same day. It was March the 26th. I abruptly stopped thinking that shutting down the last few events of the Adelaide Festival of Arts was a bit of an overreaction. Shall I say, this grabbed my attention. Osespi is one of my favourite orchestras. The Japanese-born Brazilian conductor, Naomi Munakata, was key to the development of world-class choral music in Sao Paulo. Just snuffed out. President Bolsonaro is still a COVID resistor, ignorant of his own country's history. In 1904, the government was nearly toppled as a result of making smallpox vaccinations mandatory. President Rodriguez Alves was committed to eradicating epidemics, not just smallpox. There was yellow fever and the bubonic plague. He wanted to modernize the country and attract European immigration and investment. Now, why were people so virulently opposed to methods that controlled the spread of the disease? Smallpox was more lethal than COVID, and it was disfiguring to boot if you did survive it. Critics of Brazil's 1904 public health drive often expressed their opposition in terms of the inviolability of the home, both on the streets and in courts. For elite Brazilians, this invoking this constitutional right was about protecting the privacy of their households, where men ruled over their wives, children and servants. Public health agents threatened this patriarchal authority. Poor women and men in Rio also held patriarchal values, but for them there was more than privacy at stake in 1904. Throughout the 19th century, enslaved Afro-Brazilians formed families and built homes, even on plantations, carving out spaces of relative freedom from their masters. After slavery was abolished in 1888, many freed Afro-Brazilians shared crowded tenements with immigrants. By the time of Alves' vaccination drive, the poor of Rio had been fighting eviction and police violence for decades. For black Brazilians then, defending their rights to choose what to do or not to do with their homes and bodies was part of a much longer struggle for social, economic and political inclusion. And I think you'll find parallels with today's anti-vaxxers. The fears are not necessarily related to the disease at all, but to matters of control and powerlessness. It was a deadly learning experience. From then on, Brazilian leaders framed mandatory smallpox, measles and other vaccines as means to protect the common good. That's a photo taken in the 1930s. And compliance rates with vaccination rose to 95% in Brazil and stayed there for decades until the 1990s. Vaccination rates began to drop and the country is again in deep strife, as it has a government that appears to have abandoned the concept of the common good for rhetoric about rights and choice. Today, it's one of the hardest hit by the coronavirus pandemic, and as in the past, the Afro-Brazilians are hurting more than the others. By invoking Brazilians' individual right not to get vaccinated against COVID-19, President Bolsonaro is ignoring the lessons of 1904 and undermining a century of hard work fighting disease in tropical Brazil. Fear, and how we respond to it, is largely directed by our choice of narrative. Let me explain what I mean. In 1820, 3,000 miles, that's not kilometres, 3,000 miles off the coast of Chile, sailors watched their ship filled with seawater and sink. It had been struck by a sperm whale, and the 20-odd men departed in three small whale boats. They were 10,000 miles from home, 1,000 miles from the nearest islands. The captain of the Essex, that was the name of the ship, was a 29-year-old, and his first mate could well be an ancestor of our administrative secretary, as he's from Nantucket, and his name was Owen Chase. Now, they knew the Marquesas Islands were 1,200 miles to the west, but they had heard rumours that these islands were full of cannibals. Hawaii was another possibility, but due to the season, there could be a lot of storms. The captain was pretty afraid of storms.
The last option was the longest and the most difficult, and it was sailing 1,500 miles south to meet the winds that would drive them east back onto the coast of South America. So these were their options: to be eaten by cannibals, battered by storms, or starved to death by running out of food and water. So let's call these fears stories instead of fears and see what's going on. Fears are not necessarily true. They are the stories we tell ourselves. It's the man under the bed, being hit by lightning, being kidnapped, the bogeyman, the bunyip, the zombie, the earthquake, the tsunami. We were all prone to fears as small children, and we learned over time which of these stories to discount. Fears, like stories, have characters. Us. They have plot. Plane takes off, plane starts to cough and sputter, plane crashes. They have imagery. Imagine being cooked for dinner. They have suspense. And if I'm doing my job here today, you'll be wondering what will happen next. Our fears make us think about the future. The answer to the question, what happens next, is always a story. And we are, of course, the authors of those stories. But that's not where it ends. We're also the readers of our fears, and how we choose to read our fears has a profound effect on the real life choices we make that are governed by our fears, our imaginations, our stories. Of course, we can make plans to mitigate the worst of our fears, build a bunker, pack overnight or an escape bag, take a life jacket or a 10-litre container of water with us. But we could run out of time and resources if we tried to prepare for every single contingency our scaredy-cat minds can create. Back to the Essex story. Which option did they choose? Well, it was the long route, the one likely to result in starvation. And indeed, the ones in Pollard's boat, seven men in all, were cannibalised. Three of the survivors ended up in Australia. They elected to stay on a tiny island that the crew landed on and depleted the resources in a week. After several weeks of semi-starvation, they ate everything that moved. Now, the three that remained were rescued and taken to Port Jackson. First mate Owen Chase returned to Nantucket on June 11, 1821, to find he had a 14-month daughter he'd never met. 4 months later, he completed an account of the disaster, the narrative of the most extraordinary and distressing shipwreck of the whale ship Essex. Herman Melville used this as one of the inspirations for his novel Moby Dick in 1851. In December, Chase sailed as first mate on the whaler Florida and then as captain of Winslow for each subsequent voyage until he could afford to build his own whaler. He remained at sea for 19 years, only returning home for short periods, and each time he fathered a child. His first two wives died while he was at sea, and he divorced the third because she gave birth 16 months after he'd last seen her. Interestingly, he brought the child up as his own. In December 1840, 2 months after the divorce was finalised, he married for the fourth and final time and retired from whaling. Memories of the harrowing ordeal on Essex haunted Chase, and he suffered dreadful headaches and nightmares. Later in his life, he began hiding food in the attic of his Nantucket house on Orange Street, and eventually he was institutionalised. He died aged 73. The captain returned to sea and lost another ship. By then he was considered a Jonah, and no ship owner would trust him to sail again. He was forced to retire. He subsequently became a night watchman in Nantucket. Every November the 20th, he would lock himself in his room and fast in memory of the men of the Essex. He died in 1870, that's the year after Owen Chase, and he was aged 78. So where to from here? I think we should take seriously the idea of being the author and the reader of our own fears. Leaving behind childhood and formative experiences, another major influence on our path in life is our temperament, our personality, if you like, our cast of mind. People have always tried to understand themselves in terms of categories. The Enneagram is a system of behavioural orientation that's been around for about 2,500 years. And recently it's got a lease of life from Don Riso and Russ Hudson, who've given it a modern twist. Sandy Schultheis introduced me to this concept about 10 years ago, I think. Now, the 9 types are referred to as dynamic personality patterns. The dynamic nature indicates that one's personality may change and develop over time. This depends on the ability of people to realise what their core emotional drivers are, as well as their defensive response to feeling unloved. The Enneagram represents personality patterns as defence mechanisms that are fundamentally driven by certain basic fears, explained in the Wisdom of the Enneagram. Each Enneagram type is therefore likely to show the following inherent fear. Now, none of you would be a pure type, probably. So when I say the perfectionist, think of the perfectionist streak in you, and if it's there. So perfectionists aim to be principled, good, controlled and intentional. Not having high standards or being unexceptional is unacceptable to these individuals. They can be expected to overextend themselves to achieve and steer away from what is wrong towards what is virtuous. So what they fear is being wrong or being lazy. Type 2s are helpers. They feel a strong need to be generous toward others. They prove themselves worthy of love and acceptance by taking responsibility to help and support others to the point of sacrificing their own needs. What do they fear? Being unloved and unwanted. Anybody squirming yet? Achievers or performers strive to achieve success and recognition by being ambitious, competitive, persuasive and adaptable. They feel they'll earn admiration, trust and love of others through their reputation, through their image and through impressive achievements, string of degrees, all that stuff. Now what they fear is being disrespected or feeling worthless. Romantics or individualists avoid being boring, normal, superficial, uninteresting, average, or mediocre. They seek depth, intimacy, and self-expression, and they earn love by being emotionally intense, creative, expressive, artistic, dramatic. They may also come across as temperamental or spiritually inclined. They fear meaninglessness. Observers or investigators aim at being in control by understanding their world. They are ruled by the head as opposed to the heart, seeking learning and insight, and they want to avoid feeling ignorant or inadequate or clueless. They earn the respect and acceptance of others by being competent and effective, and what they fear is not knowing. Type 6 is an interesting one. They're loyalists or guardians. They deeply engage with others and their environments to ensure that all is well. They have a very strong sense of responsibility and respond to their inner distrust and doubt by being vigilant. Also, very supportive of others and a bit controlling. They're loyal and strive for security and connection with others, and they fear chaos. Now, enthusiasts, very different, seek sensation, fun, stimulation and variety to avoid feeling disappointment or pain or fear. Their spontaneous and versatile behaviour, the fun of the party, is aimed at pursuing desires that they fear will not be fulfilled by others, and what they fear is deprivation. Now, bossy sorts, challengers, come across as willful, self-directed and confident. They're really good at being guardians. Their core fear is to be controlled, violated, betrayed, or limited by circumstances. They avoid this by taking control in a powerful and self-sufficient way to ensure that they get what they want and everybody else is looked after as well. What they fear is being controlled. And the last one, I know we've got a few of these, peacemakers. They're fearful of conflict, disharmony, and being disconnected from others. They therefore refrain from questioning or challenging themselves or other people, and instead accommodate others to maintain peace, harmony, and stability. What they fear is to be confronted. Now, these types are not destinies or fixed characteristics. They're tendencies which we can discern and respond to rationally. We are the author and the readers of our own fears. The human condition encompasses fear as well as love. It encompasses joy as well as suffering. Moira Thomas used to say, we are driven by fear or love, and it is up to us to choose. The banner outside our church challenges us to stand on the side of love and compassion. May we find the strength to do just that. You may stand for the benediction today, if you're able. We leave this gathered community, but we don't leave our connection, our concerns, or our care for each other, our service to each other and to the world. Be strong, be well, be true, be loving.
We hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.